Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is January 29, 1982, and this is my audio letter number 71. On the afternoon of Wednesday, January 13, there was a rare blizzard here in Washington, D.C. Government offices and businesses closed up early to allow workers to head home. As commuters fought their way through the worsening snowstorm, the nation's capital turned into one giant traffic jam. The worst jams of all were on the bridges that led across the Potomac River to the nearby suburbs in Virginia. Motorists inched across the snow-swept bridges in bumper-to-bumper traffic. Only a few hundred feet above the jam-packed bridges, jet airliners were climbing into the swirling snowstorm. The planes were taking off from National Airport, nestled next to the river just south of the heart of Washington. Following required procedures, the jets were twisting and turning to stay over the Potomac River as they climbed. Suddenly, drivers on the twin 14th Street bridges, closest of all to the airport, looked up in horror. A blue, green, and white jetliner came screaming down out of the blizzard. There was a deafening roar, a smashing of metal that shook the bridge, a giant splash that shattered the smooth ice on the Potomac. Then for a shocked moment, silence. Then pandemonium as people poured out of their stalled cars. On the bridge, there was a grisly scene of wrecked cars. A 50-foot span of the bridge railing was gone, and in the river below, the shattered remains of the jetliner were fast sinking out of sight. Soon, special news bulletins were flashing across the country. An Air Florida Boeing 737 Flight 90 to Tampa, Florida, had crashed on takeoff from Washington's National Airport. In the immediate aftermath of the tragedy, news reports focused on the heart-rending human interest aspects of the crash. Time after time, we have seen television scenes of the makeshift rescue efforts. Few will soon forget those numbing scenes of a precious few survivors being fished out of the icy Potomac River. Millions were inspired by the heroism of a bystander who risked his own life by swimming out to rescue a drowning woman. And, my friends, our Lord Jesus Christ Himself will reward the greatest hero of all that day. He was the crash survivor who time after time passed the rescue ring to others and then perished himself. He was the man to whom the entity President Reagan referred the following day in a New York City speech. Speaking as he was in the true Bolshevik Zionist capital of the United States, our alleged president misquoted our Lord Jesus Christ in the words, "Greater glory has no man," unquote. Surely the man who gave his life that others might live deserves a better epitaph than a politician's preoccupation with glory. What our Lord Jesus Christ really said was, "Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends." That is what our Lord Himself did nearly 2,000 years ago, and that is what the man in the water did after the crash of the Air Florida Flight 90. My friends, the very human tragedy of the crash of Flight 90 is important all by itself. But if we are to have any hope of avoiding even greater tragedies that are looming ahead, we must look beyond the human interest stories. We need the answers to some important questions, such as, why was there a plane crash at all that day? Why that plane? And what made it crash? We are being led to believe that we are being given answers to those questions. But the true answers, my friends, are far different from what you have heard up to now. The crash of Air Florida Flight 90 was a terrible tragedy, but it was also more than that. It was also intended as a warning to certain powerful circles here in the United States. And as such, it was not an isolated incident, but part of a much larger pattern now taking shape. For some 5 years now, a secret war has been underway between the present rulers of Russia and those of the United States. The secret war has waxed and waned, and now it's heating up once again. In the ongoing secret war, it is now Russia that is taking the offensive. Having put out the fuse on the Poland time bomb, at least for the moment, the Kremlin is now counterattacking against their Bolshevik enemies here. Russia's secret new rulers are trying to send a message to the Bolsheviks who have seized power here in America. The message is, war does not pay. The Russians are delivering this warning message in many ways which are totally unsuspected by most of the public. My friends, the Russians are once again unleashing geophysical warfare against the United States and against some of our allies. One aspect of this geophysical onslaught is weather warfare. The crash of Air Florida Flight 90 was brought about in the midst of largely man-made severe weather. The Russians are also firing warning shots across America's bow by means of another geophysical warfare weapon, artificial earthquakes. The Russians are also readying themselves for attack on another front, the economy of America and the West. This month, January 1982, the Kremlin has scored a stunning economic coup. Before the year is out, the entire economy of the United States will be vulnerable to a total collapse at Russia's hands. In this audio letter, I want to give you the details about the new Russian offensive now underway. Also, I plan to resume reporting each month by means of the audio letter tape series. Based on the response of my comments in audio letter 70 last month, I believe this is the best way I can serve you after all at this time. I will say more about that in my last minute summary. My three special topics for this audio letter are topic number 1, the Siberian Express and renewed Russian geophysical warfare. Topic number 2, Russia's secret economic coup in dollar assets. And topic number 3, the shifting alliances for nuclear war 1. Topic number 1. In his famous Liberty or Death speech of March 1775, Patrick Henry said some words that have taken on new meaning in our modern age. He said, quote, "Gentlemen may cry peace, peace, but there is no peace. The war is actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms," unquote. Today, voices in Washington talk of keeping the peace, but today, even more than in Patrick Henry's day, the cries of peace are a sham. A secret war is underway, and this month unprecedented gales have swept in from the north as part of that secret war. For the United States as a whole, January 1982 has been the most severe in history. Records for low temperatures have been broken by wide margins in countless places, from the Canadian border to Florida. There has been blizzard piled on blizzard to paralyze even the northern states who are accustomed to snow. And in vast areas of the southern United States, there have been historically unprecedented blasts of sub-zero Arctic air. Snowstorms, sleet storms, freezing rain, bitter cold. That has been the story for the eastern two-thirds of the United States this January. Meanwhile, the West Coast has primarily faced a different problem. Spells of incredible rainstorms causing giant mudslides and many deaths. And caught in between, the Rocky Mountain states have had their own unique problems. There have been violent windstorms with winds in some areas more powerful than most hurricanes. Only a few days ago, winds reached an awesome 140 miles per hour in northern Colorado. The National Weather Service of the United States has come up with a popular nickname for the repeated invasions of Arctic air this winter. They are calling it the Siberian Express, quote-unquote, and with good reason. Northern Siberia in the Soviet Union is one of the coldest regions on the face of the earth. That is exactly where the super-cooled air has been coming from to spill all across North America. And, my friends, it has been directed here by weather modification techniques. Russia's basic weapons for massive weather modification are still as I reported nearly 2 years ago in Audio Letter 54. The Russians used two legs of their secret space triad of manned strategic weapons. One leg is their fleet of cosmospheres, which levitate in the Earth's electromagnetic field. Using their beam weapons, they are able to guide storm systems by altering the electrical charges in the upper atmosphere. And to set off certain types of storms, the Russians use another leg of their secret space triad, that is, their complex of moon bases. The enormously powerful particle beam weapons on the moon can be fired into the ocean to set off storms. Squadrons of cosmospheres then take advantage of natural weather forces to build up and guide these artificial storms. I describe the process in detail in Audio Letter 54, so we'll not repeat it again now. As I revealed at that time, the Russians began using these new weather war techniques against the United States that month, February 1980. The Kremlin was counterattacking against the Carter administration grain embargo against Russia. The Bolsheviks here were trying to use their old favorite weapon, hunger, against the Russia they used to control. Russia's new rulers responded with weather control designed to reduce our crops. And in February 1980, that took the form of incredible rainstorms, lashing agricultural areas of Southern California and Arizona. The Carter administration grain embargo continued through the summer of 1980, and so did Russian weather modification. Much to the surprise of long-range weather forecasters here, the summer of 1980 set records for drought and blistering heat. Crops died for lack of rain and excessive heat. Thousands of cattle died for the same reasons. In the Southwest, millions of chickens fried on their feet under the blistering heat wave. Water shortages started multiplying nationwide. And to drive the point home to our then peanut farmer president, the peanut crop failed, something previously unheard of. The Bolsheviks here still continued the grain embargo through the end of 1980. There was about to be a change of administration, and the new administration was expected to end the embargo. But just to make sure, the Russians kept up the pressure. In January 1981, just 1 year ago, a strange cold wave hit the United States. As the late Washington Star reported on January 13, 1981, quote, Siberian cold spread a record freeze across the southeast today, dipping deep into Florida, where citrus and vegetable growers fought to save their crops against the worst winter onslaught of the century, unquote. That day it was announced that 25% of Florida citrus crops had been killed by the freeze. The freeze had also killed up to half of America's supply of certain vegetables. If that news report of a year ago has a familiar ring to it, my friends, it certainly ought to. The strange river of Arctic air that froze America's east coast and damaged Florida's crops 1 year ago this month was a product of Russian weather modification. It was a limited taste of what could be done. It was a warning to America's rulers that they were courting disaster with their campaign of hunger against Russia. 3 months later, the grain embargo against Russia was lifted. In response, Russian weather war against America was terminated, and last summer, the summer of 1981, returned to normal in terms of weather. That is how it stood until mid-December. Then came martial law in Poland, and by then the American Bolsheviks, who did not initially control the so-called Reagan administration, had regained power here in Washington. Right away, the entity President Reagan started talking about sanctions against Russia, just as his predecessor had done over Afghanistan. And once again, the new administration started saying that a new grain embargo should be considered against Russia. This time, said the President, steps should be taken to make the embargo airtight. That was enough for Russia's new rulers. They know about the efforts by the Reagan-Begin axis to bring on war, and they are convinced that the time to talk is growing very short. They are convinced that war is inevitable between Russia and Russia's recently expelled masters, the Bolsheviks, who are now here in America. So in late December, the Politburo agreed that the time had come to take the offensive against the United States. The Russian weather offensive began with a rainstorm attack against the West Coast. Using the techniques I detailed in Audio Letter 54, Cosmospheres were deployed partly offshore and partly inland. Those offshore, deployed in quadrangles of four Cosmospheres each, used defocus electron beams to set up negatively charged vapor clouds. Inland some distance from the coast, duos of two Cosmospheres each loaded the atmosphere with positively charged protons from defocused beam weapons. This resulted in the movement of vast quantities of water to target areas for release as rain. The rainstorm attack formation was set up to bring varying amounts of rainfall to most of the West Coast, especially California. But the area chosen as a primary target was a 200-mile stretch centered on San Francisco. The reason for selecting San Francisco is very simple. Russia's new ruling group regard the United States as degenerate, and the most degenerate of all West Coast cities, in their view, is San Francisco. For several days, beginning on January 5, the region around San Francisco was drenched by unrelenting torrents of rain. It continued until San Francisco was isolated, cut off by flood waters. And in the Santa Cruz area, south of San Francisco, half a mountainside collapsed, carrying with it houses, cars, and more than 20 victims. By the weekend, the rainstorm attack was tapering off. The next weather attack was brewing in the form of a vast wave of Arctic air. The first Siberian Express was on the way. The technique used for the Siberian Express is a new variation on the Cosmosphere techniques of Audio Letter 54. The Russians have now learned how to take a huge air mass from one place in the world and transport it to another area of the planet. First, the Russians deployed a large number of Cosmospheres, 17 squadrons in all, over northeastern Siberia. The area covered ranged from about 105 to 170 degrees east longitude, and latitudes from 65 degrees northward to the Arctic Ocean. These Cosmospheres used defocus electron beams over a period of days to give a strong negative charge to the whole frigid air mass. The Siberian air temperature ranged from 60 to 70 degrees below zero. Next, a series of Cosmosphere squadrons were deployed at intervals of roughly 1,000 miles across the North Pacific toward America. These Cosmosphere squadrons, like beads on a necklace, followed a line from a point north of Japan to the vicinity of Eureka, Northern California. The Cosmospheres in this trans-Pacific line formed the tracks for the Siberian Express air mass to follow. Hovering at the fringes of space, they pumped out vast quantities of positive protons to attract the Siberian air mass toward America. The negatively charged Siberian air was attracted eastward and also higher than normal, where it moved relatively unaffected by lower atmosphere weather patterns. On weather maps, the Siberian air masses are drawn as if they are flowing down horizontally from Canada, but the Siberian air actually arrives by a different route. It is pulled in over northwestern North America above the other weather. Then from the continental divide eastward, Cosmospheres pull it down to flood the land with super cold air. In other words, it spills all over North America primarily from above, not by the normal horizontal path. The Siberian air reaches here so fast by this man-made route that it does not warm up as much as it would otherwise. The result? Bone-chilling weather that has many weathermen scratching their heads. And as a byproduct of this technique, violent windstorms are created around the edges of the downward spilling Siberian air. These are especially intense along the Rocky Mountains. The first Siberian Express cold wave was timed carefully. Earlier I mentioned the January 13, 1981 reports of a freeze that destroyed part of Florida's crops. This year, the news on January 13, 1 year later to the day, a killer freeze had once again just hit Florida. Only this time, it was far worse. Last January, damage amounted to some $230 million. But this time, as much as 84% of the Florida citrus and vegetable crops froze for losses of over $1 billion. The news of Florida's staggering crop losses came on Wednesday, January 13. That same afternoon, an Air Florida Boeing 737 tried to take off from National Airport here in Washington. It was the ill-fated Flight 90, bound for Tampa, Florida. Flight 90 and many others were delayed that afternoon because of the snowstorm. The main runway, which runs north and south, was closed for over an hour while the snow was cleaned off. Meanwhile, Flight 90 and other planes boarded their passengers and waited at the terminal. As they waited, ground crew sprayed a kind of antifreeze solution on the planes. A surviving passenger of Flight 90, himself a pilot, was quoted 2 days later in the Washington Post in the words, "They were de-icing the aircraft continuously," unquote. Finally, word came from the control tower that the runway was ready. Jetliners started pulling away from the terminal, lining up to taxi out to the runway. It was still snowing, but reportedly it was a cold, dry snow, much less likely to cause icing than sleet or freezing rain. Later, one of the pilots of another plane said he thought he had seen ice on the Air Florida jet. Other pilots, though, said they had seen no ice at all on it. As Flight 90 waited its turn, 18 other airplanes took off without any apparent difficulty. One was a 737 like the Air Florida jet, belonging to another airline. Unlike Flight 90, it was carrying a full load of passengers. It took off without incident. But the Air Florida jet was destined to be less fortunate. Unknown to the other passengers, there were 5 important military personnel aboard. They were members of a special laser warfare task force assigned to the home of the so-called Rapid Deployment Force in Florida. That is the military force, my friends, which is undergoing highly secret preparations for the coming Middle East war. Having engaged in meetings at the Pentagon, the men were returning to their home base in Florida. At last, the Air Florida 737 took its position at the end of the runway. As it did so, it was being tracked by a Russian Cosmosphere, hovering high above the airport in the midst of storm clouds. It was armed with a neutron beam weapon. At 3:59 p.m., the jet started its takeoff roll down the runway. The Cosmosphere waited until the jet was about halfway down the runway and moving over 100 miles per hour. Then the invisible neutron beam was fired down through the snow at the cockpit of the jetliner. In Audio Letter 64, I describe the effects which are produced by an intense blast of neutron radiation. It disrupts all electrical activity. That includes the electrical activity of the human body, including the brain, the eyes, the nervous system, and the heart. When the beam was fired at the Air Florida jet, it was expected that the pilot and co-pilot would be instantly rendered unconscious or killed. That would have left the jet still accelerating, perhaps drifting off the runway, and finally leaving the boundaries of the small airport to plunge into the river. It would have been a very strange crash, and one very hard for government officials here to explain away to the public. But the Russians miscalculated. individuals vary considerably in their resistance to neutron radiation effects, and apparently someone in the cockpit retained some shred of consciousness. I cannot tell you what went on in the cockpit, but I can tell you what the plane did. The jet continued down the runway instead of drifting off. There was also an effort to apply the brakes, yet the engines kept going full blast. The plane started shuddering, but the brakes could not prevent the plane from continuing to accelerate slowly. The plane reached full takeoff speed as it ran out of runway and rotated upward into a climb. At that point, it's believed that whoever was at the controls may have finally blacked out. The plane was pointing upward far too steeply and started mushing through the air instead of climbing normally. No pilot or co-pilot would have let that continue, and yet it was never corrected. Equally startling, the landing gear was never pulled up. Normally, the gear is lifted immediately after takeoff to help streamline the plane. That would be even more urgent if a pilot were having troubles with ice, as has been alleged, or if a crash landing were imminent. But when the Air Florida jet dropped out of the snowy sky that afternoon, it was still nose up and gear down. And from brake release to impact, there was never a mayday call from Flight 90. 5 days later, a Russian Cosmosphere triggered another spectacular plane crash to continue driving home the warning to our leaders. The pride of the Air Force, the aerial demonstration team called the Thunderbirds, were practicing near Indian Springs Air Force Base, Nevada. They were practicing a maneuver known as line-abreast loop, in which the four T-38 jets swoop down in a steep dive and then pull up close to the ground. It is not considered the most difficult of the Thunderbirds' maneuvers, but it does call for close coordination. The leader concentrates on getting the loop just right. The other three concentrate on following the leader precisely. That afternoon, over the Nevada desert, a Cosmosphere was waiting. As the four jets screamed earthward, the Cosmosphere waited until they neared the ground. Then a neutron beam was fired at the cockpit of the lead plane, incapacitating the pilot. The lead plane plowed into the desert, and the other three, following the leader, did the same. Meanwhile, by that time, the nation was in the grip of the Second Siberian Express super cold wave. And, my friends, Russia's geophysical warfare campaign includes other things besides the weather. In audio letter 59, 15 months ago, I reported that Russian earthquake-generating cobalt bombs had been planted in the Northeast. They are concentrated most heavily around New York City, but as I reported then, also extend northeast into New England. Since that time, additional earthquake generators have been planted, and this month they have been used twice. On the morning of January 9, an earthquake measured at 5.9 on the Richter scale was set off in eastern Canada near Maine. It was the worst New England earthquake in 127 years. 9 days later, a second earthquake was set off, this time in New Hampshire. If there should be another earthquake soon in the Northeast, don't be surprised if it is even closer to New York City. The Russians are on the offensive, and our war-crazy rulers are refusing to heed these warnings.